Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. On this podcast, I get to chat to incredible people working in or influencing the healthcare environment. Today's guest, Professor David Jain, and I have known each other for a bunch of years and collaborated on several projects together, and he has certainly had a massive influence. David was born in Coventry in the United Kingdom and was educated at the University of Wales College of Medicine, obtaining a bachelor's degree in biology before completing his medical degrees. He did his house jobs, or internship for our American listeners, worked as an anatomy demonstrator in Leeds for a year, and then as a resident surgical officer in Perth, Western Australia. He returned to the UK and undertook surgical training in Manchester, did 2 years of research with Professor Guyou in Leeds, and then a colorectal fellowship in Singapore. David was appointed to St. James's Hospital in Leeds as an academic consultant colorectal surgeon, and was elevated to the rank of professor in 2011 and became an associate dean in 2018. In all the time I've known David, he's always sought to explore new thinking, new ways of doing things, but in a responsible and cautious manner. Not just an inventor, Professor Jain is an innovator and an excellent narrator to communicate his findings and conclusions. We're not guddling around in the abdominal nether regions or spending time with his family. David is devoted to his polytunnel. For those of you not in the know, and I certainly wasn't, that is an enclosure used to grow plants. David told me that vicious rumours suggesting he uses it to grow cannabis are completely unfounded. Professor David Jain, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And I think I'm going to have to pay a visit and check out this polytunnel. So, David, as was clear from my introduction, you've had a global education and continue to foster many global collaborations. What lessons do you think doctors, surgeons can learn by being citizens of the world to best enhance clinical practice and innovation? And we've seen, for instance, in this wretched pandemic, I've used the expression, I didn't develop it, but someone sneezes in Wuhan, someone catches a cold in Leeds. What can we learn by being global citizens?
So I think it's very, very important that we use every opportunity to expand our mind and our thinking. I think it's all too easy to become quite insular in what you do, to get into a comfortable position and just do more of the same things, the same way. And in the UK, there is a tendency for us to adopt a sort of what I call an island mentality. That is, we do things this way, and that's the right way and the way that it should be done. And I think it's the beauty of travel, isn't it? The ability to meet working in the same area. And these people are faced with the same problems that we have, but can often come to solutions in a very different way. And so it's the networking, the meeting people, exploring new ideas, thinking out of the box. This way we can learn and we can bring these new thoughts back to our own practice. So I think it's crucially important that we do mix internationally if we are going to actually drive our healthcare forwards.
Do you think we used to joke back in the day that people had got their BTA, been to America? I stayed in America for a very long time, and I guess it was learning about different healthcare systems. It's just something as simple as in the UK using a pre-anesthetic room to turn rooms over faster. The United States solution was, instead of doing that, just build 60 or 70 operating theatres. So, there are different ways of doing things. And sometimes you look and go, yeah, no, that doesn't work for me. What are your thoughts about during the pandemic, the way that much of our international collaborations have been by Zoom, if you will, or a similar platform? Are you satisfied with that, or is there anything that you miss about going to conferences, for instance?
So I think Zoom and other platforms have their advantages. For example, we host innovation workshops and conferences online. And what we've seen is the participation has really increased. So previously, we might have held an innovation conference in Leeds, and people have to travel. And, you know, London to Leeds is 2 hours. It's just about doable. It's much easier just to log in on a computer. So you can really get much wider reach. And what we see is if we hold an innovation conference, we get people from Korea, Taiwan, the States, logging in and joining in those conferences, which we would never have got had it been a face-to-face meeting. So I think there are great advantages in terms of reach and the breadth of participation. The problem is that the quality of the networking, you can't beat face-to-face discussions if you want to have a real in-depth conversation about something. So I went to Amsterdam 2 weeks ago. It's the first overseas sort of conference I've been to. It was a workshop on fluorescent imaging. And it really brought home to me what we'd actually been missing whilst we'd been all working online. And just to come back to your point about the being to America. Yeah, I think there's benefits in that. I would actually encourage our trainees now to actually think slightly differently about it. I mean, I think if I was a trainee now, I would probably derive a lot more benefit by going somewhere like India, because the volumes of work, India or China, the volumes of work that these centers are getting through, it would be a brilliant experience to spend 6 months, 12 months in a good Indian or Chinese center. I think there'd be tremendous learning rather than perhaps going to another healthcare system which is quite similar to our own. So I think we can do a lot more in exposing our trainees to different environments and improving the learning.
Absolutely. Of course, we've also got to take into consideration our carbon footprints. And your comment about the casual conversations or the quality of interactions, going to a conference, bumping into an old mate and just sitting and having a bit of a chat, and something, you know, very often meaningful came out of it, you know, a job for a junior, a research collaboration, guidance on how to deal with a specific clinical problem. So yes, we do miss that, but your point is well taken. So when we were setting this up, David, you used the terms frugal innovation and reverse innovation. What did you mean by those?
Well, this comes out of some of the work that we've been doing over the past years, funded by NIHR. We got funding for a global health research group. So that was a project over 3 years, and it funded us to do research in 2 countries, one in Sierra Leone and the other in northeast India, really rural India, right up under the Chinese borders in the foothills of the Himalayas. And it was through my work, my research in that context, that I really became aware of these ideas. Frugal innovation means really doing more with less. And it's those sort of low resource settings that this is it's an absolute necessity. It's not a luxury. That's how you have to work. But at the same time, it doesn't mean compromising on standards or quality. So it's really about thinking out of the box. How can you do things as well, or if not better, but perhaps using resources more efficiently? So, the classic example that everyone knows of this is the hernia mesh. So in high-income countries, we will pay, tens and hundreds of pounds for a piece of mesh to repair a hernia. whereas you can get exactly the same result for a few pence using mosquito netting. So it's just that thinking slightly differently. Reverse innovation sort of follows on from that. Now, the traditional medical devices innovation has typically been in high-income countries where there's the research and development infrastructures, and then it flows to low-income countries depending on whether they can afford it. And reverse innovation flips that, if you like. So there's an awful lot of innovation going on in low-resource settings by necessity. And it's about working with partners in those settings to really develop those new innovations and then bringing them back to the high-income setting. And that way, both partners can benefit. So the low-income partners benefit from having input to help with the development and speed the process up. And the high-income partners hopefully benefit by having more cost-effective solutions. So I think these are two concepts that we really have to try and bring into our current practices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Bruce Keogh once said to me that the only difference between the British and the American healthcare systems was that Britain was broke and knew it. America was broke and hadn't worked it out yet. I think he was right. And we've got to spend money more responsibly and innovate more responsibly. So staying with innovation, you've been involved with the National Institutes of Health Research, the NIHR, here in the UK as a professor, clinical director, and you're still involved. Tell our audience who may not know about the work of the NIHR and what you've been up to.
The NIHR is really a fabulous institution. It's can be thought of as the research arm of the NHS. So the NHS is the delivery arm, and the NIHR is the research arm. It's been in existence for over 10 years now. And it's made fantastic achievements. I think it's really revolutionized how we undertake translational research in the UK. And it's about having that dedicated funding pot. I think the NIHR's funding pot is around just over £1 billion a year. And it's about investing strategically in those areas that we really need to innovate in to see improvements in our health and social care. So I've been lucky to benefit from NIHR funding in many ways. So many of the big portfolio studies that we've run over the years started off with a classic trial looking at laparoscopic versus open surgery for colorectal cancer. That was NIHR funded. Moved on to then our ROLAR trial, which took it to the next stage, which was robotic versus laparoscopic surgery for rectal cancer. And more recently, NIHR fund what we call the INTACT study. And that's looking at fluorescent angiography, so fluorescent perfusion, to try and reduce anastomotic leak following rectal cancer surgery, which is, you know, Jonathan, is one of our big unsolved challenges in colorectal surgery. So I've been lucky enough to have a lot of my clinical trials research funded by NIHR. They also funded me for a period of 5 years as what they call a research professorship, which was a really fantastic opportunity. Basically, they buy out your salary and give you the resources and the time, and that's really important, the time to concentrate on your research. And I used those 5 years to really drive the research that I was interested in around new surgical technologies. And then other NIHR funding that I'm lucky enough to have is I'm clinical director for what is called a medtech cooperative. They're referred to as MICS for short. And these are about forming national networks. So our MedTech cooperative, again, is around surgical technologies. And it's about bringing together clinicians, academics, industry, public and patient into big national networks so that we can really pull through new innovation into clinical practice. Jonathan, I'm going to have to stop. I've got an old dog in the room here who's beginning to snore.
I it's actually quite charming. We've had during this period of time of people working from home, we've had dogs barking to go outside, dogs barking to come back in, but we've never had a snoring dog. And as the expression goes, David, let sleeping dogs lie. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, the audience might think that you've nodded off while I'm talking.
Well, we've now explained to them, David, so I think it's fine. So,
can you give me 2 minutes? And I'll just extract the dog before I go. 2 minutes.
Come on, Oli.
Right, I'm back.
Okay, so now that the dog has gone to snooze off his night on the town somewhere else, David, you know, one of the things that you did, you put together a conference which I came to one of your events, and you'd brought together clinicians, research scientists, clever folks from lots of disciplines, and patients to drive a new kind of dialogue. And it's clear to me that you believe we need to get more interactions between those who spend their time, you know, elbow deep in gore, and those ruminating in a lab, and those actually living with the disease. Tell us about what drives your thinking here.
So I was really interested in, I've always been fascinated by exposing myself to other disciplines. And I guess it's part of the inquisitive or learning process. That it's good, it's fun to work with people who think differently about the world. And, you know, there's a tendency for us in medicine, traditionally in surgery, things have changed, but surgical research used to be very molecular orientated. So when I was doing my higher degree, there was no option but to go into the lab and pipette things and do PCR work. I think that has changed very definitely, and it comes back to the NIHR funding and the funding that's gone into clinical trials. So there's been a massive swing of our youngsters now doing more translational clinical trials research, which to some degree, I think it may almost have gone too far, because I'm worried that there are not enough surgeons doing the basic science research. I worry that we will lose that skill set. But I became fascinated in working with engineers, and I formed some very close partnerships with various engineering scientists. And what triggered it really was I was trying to think about taking robotics to the next level. It was at that stage when it was about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when people were exploring natural orifice surgery. And, you know, endoluminal scarless surgery, as it was called. And I was trying to think about how we could miniaturize robotics to the scale where we could put little robots inside cavities to perform various manipulations and maneuvers. And obviously I'm a GI surgeon, so, you know, the abdominal cavity is what I'm interested in. And the big problem there if you develop a robot, it's got to be mobile. It's got to be able to move around the abdominal cavity. And as you know, Jonathan, the lining of the abdominal cavity is the peritoneum, which by design is made to be a slippery surface. So how do you get miniature robots to stick to and walk across these slippery surfaces? The people to go to solve those sort of problems are the engineers, or more specifically, the tribologists, because these are the people who understand about friction and adhesion. And we did some really interesting work. It was a bit blue sky. I totally understand that. But it did get funded by EPSRC. And we did some work around biomimetics. So copying nature to try and solve these problems. And in particular, the adhesion one to slippery surfaces. We used the principle of the African tree frog, which is able to stick to wet environments. And by copying that, we were actually able to build miniature robots that could stick to and walk on slippery peritoneum. So that's just, you know, one example where you have to bring in other people with other knowledge if you're really going to come up with solutions to some of these quite difficult questions.
I think you're absolutely right. I was just looking back at recently at some work that was being done, looking at things that we could learn from the sea. And for instance, shark skin has been recapitulated as a covering or a painting, a surface for ships to prevent barnacle adhesion. So there are all sorts of clever solutions that we can apply. So sticking with the research theme, you're a member of COMET, the Medical Research Council, or MRC, Core Outcome Measures in Effectiveness in Clinical Trials. I bet whoever dreamed that one up felt very pleased with themselves. So anyone who's tried to bring a new med tech to market knows that it can take a long time, cost a lot of money. How can we do better to responsibly but cost-effectively speed treatments to those who need them?
So I think one of the problems we've got is that our innovation pipeline is very fragmented. So I'm mainly taking the academic perspective here rather than perhaps the industry perspective, but it does apply to industry as well. So typically the basic innovation is done within the higher education institutes, the universities, etc. And this is where the scientists explore and come up with new ideas and new solutions. But the problem is that no one person has the skill set to take an innovation all the way from discovery to clinical adoption. You need different people with different skill sets along that pathway. So it's clearly important that you need to build that team right from the beginning, because you need the right people invested in it right from the start. And then it's about what I call passing the ball. So if you're a rugby team, the ball comes out of the scrum, it goes to the scrum half, to the fly half, to the centre, out to the wing, and the winger will hopefully get the ball over the try line. And the same thing applies. The discovery scientist needs to move the ball to the people with the preclinical expertise. They need to move the ball to the early phase scientists. They need to move the ball to the late phase clinical trialists. They need to involve the healthcare economics guys and the implementation scientists. So it's about getting that skill set, getting the ducks lined up, so when the innovation comes, it can be moved swiftly along that line to get it into clinical practice.
Yeah, it's, the FDA in the United States has developed a number of mechanisms like the breakthrough designation. And you're absolutely right, you know, so that's the regulatory side, but you're absolutely right. It's a team mentality, and you've got to take your ego out of the equation. So I want to go back to robots, because I know you've been involved with robotics for a long time. You've served as clinical advisor to NHS England. You're a founding member of the European Academy of Robotic Surgery, among other groups, and led the ROLAR trial, the robotic versus laparoscopic resection. And you mentioned that. You mentioned sort of Fantastic Voyage type robots wandering around your abdomen and getting up to all sorts of fascinating things. What's the future for robotics? And you've mentioned global surgery. These technologies, you know, it's very high tech, they're very expensive. Do they have a role in global medical healthcare?
I think that's a really interesting question. It's something we've struggled with, isn't it, over the last decade. We have a technology that that is fantastic. You know, the surgical robots, the intuitive robot is a fantastic bit of kit. But the big problem we've had is, you know, it's really very expensive. You know, a couple of million pounds for a robotic system. And the dilemma we've had is that we it's been impossible really to show patient benefit from those systems, apart from in perhaps some quite niche areas. So one thinks about, you know, prostatectomy. It's revolutionized prostatectomy. In other areas, particularly in colorectal, it's been quite a struggle. And the reason because of that is because the operation you do is essentially the same. All you do is changing the tool. So instead of having, you know, cold steel, a scalpel or a laparoscope, we now have a very sophisticated system. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it does the same operation. The operation hasn't changed. And, you know, the surgical insult to the patient hasn't changed. So that's been the dilemma for us. What the Rollar study did show, though, were the main drivers of the cost and why robotic surgery was, you know, for colorectal cancer, it's about £1,000 more per operation than laparoscopic surgery. And those two costs, the two main drivers were, one, the length of the operation. Robotic operations take longer. And the instrument costs were more expensive. So I think there is some really nice innovation coming through. People are starting to think about how we can drive those costs down. So the new manufacturers, the competition is opening up, and hopefully that will bring the costs down. And there's some nice work on various hybrid systems. So these are systems that combine both laparoscopic and robotics, and you can choose, you know, which modality you need to use when. And you can really start to bring the cost of those operations down with those systems. So I think we're going to see, you know, pressures on the market as it opens up with more and more players in the space. But for me, I think, you know, robotics has been around, robotic systems, for 20 plus years, and we've got to sort of get beyond the sort of research that we're doing now, which is kind of, I've got a robot, what can I use it for? And I think we've got to start thinking about the exciting opportunities as the digital world opens up. And the big questions are really, how do we integrate these sophisticated digital platforms within the whole digital patient pathway? So it's not just the robot in isolation. The robot is a digital platform, but how does it fit with all the information we're going to be gathering on preoperative, perioperative, and postoperative? And it's about fusing all those data sets to really try to understand how we can improve patient care.
Great points, one and all. One other thing I'd throw out is the opportunity to use robotic systems within a philanthropic approach like the World Telehealth Initiative. Quick plug for my friend Yulin Wang's new activity. And, you know, I collaborated with Yulin on a couple of other projects, including the first robot, the ESOP, and now deploying robots to bring complex medical care around the world. So, you know, it can be sort of like reverse innovation, if you will.
I think that's a good point. And the other area that I'm quite interested in, well, I hope we've got a funding application in at the moment, is using digital platforms for training. So, you know, traditionally we've had this preceptorship model of training, which is very, very slow. So you go and you do a lab course, come back, your proctor comes over, they proctor you for 10 cases, and then eventually you get signed off. Now, that takes years to do. And this is why laparoscopic surgery took, you know, 10, 15 years really to start gaining considerable traction. And I think the beauty of, you know, digital platforms, we've been working with a company called Proximy, and, you know, you can do the remote preceptoring, provided you've got all the safety regulations in place. But there's no need for a proctor to have to travel hundreds of miles. Or in what we're looking at setting up laparoscopic surgery in Kenya. But I can do that from our office in Leeds. And the platforms are so good now, the augmented reality, you can actually put your hand into the operating field and you can point and say, cut here, don't cut there, etc. And we've really got to start using these platforms to speed up our processes for training.
Absolutely. So I want to go back to your mention of laparoscopic surgery in the 1980s. It changed how we work, and that was largely led, that clinical revolution was largely led by non-academics. Do you think it's symptomatic of a problem that academics rarely translate innovation into meaningful impact?
I think, it's a balance, isn't it? You have to get the balance right. You know, you can over-evaluate things. So, you know, safety, patient safety is paramount. And before we can take any innovation, you know, into clinical practice, we've got to be confident that it will do what it is supposed to do and it will do it safely. So we do have to evaluate. But I think you can over-evaluate. You can spend years and years studying things. And the risk, obviously, then, is that you know, patients aren't benefiting from innovations which, in effect, are being held back. The flip side to that, though, is that we've seen a lot of patient harm by innovations being introduced too early when we didn't really understand what they did or the consequences of them. So probably in the UK in recent years, you know, the biggest example of that has been the mesh scandal, mainly for gynecological pelvic floor prolapse and the harm that that's done. And that was because we really didn't understand what happened when you started implanting mesh against, you know, soft tissues and often dynamic structures that moved and you were putting rigid meshes next to them. So it's that balance. We do have to evaluate, we do have to understand, and we do have to have confidence in the efficacy and the safety profile. But we mustn't be too academic about it and over-evaluate. Otherwise, that in itself can be as harmful.
Yeah, absolutely. A good point. So one final question about surgical research. You said to me it could be seen as a comic opera. What did you mean by that? Where are we with surgical research?
So the comic opera, a much quoted phrase from The Lancet about 10 years ago now, I think it was, when the editor of the Lancet described surgical research as a comic opera. I think there were many people in the surgical research community who were horrified by that description. I think there was, you know, an element of truth in it. In the surgical research at that time, there was an awful lot of my personal series. I've done 50 of these, you know, I've done 100 of those, all prospective sort of studies, all full of bias. And it was, you know, it was lacking quality. I think we've now learned, you know, over the last decade, where surgeons have learned how to do proper studies, how to do randomized controlled trials and to do them well. And this comes back to the point around NIHR. Much of that learning has only been made possible through the funding that has flowed from NIHR, both for its funding for research, but also its funding through various training and fellowship schemes. So interestingly, the Royal College of Surgeons of England are currently putting together a state-of-the-art paper to look at exactly where we are in surgical research now, 10 years on from the comic opera. And I think we'll see that we've moved on really quite considerably.
I just love the expression comic opera, except none of us can sing, of course. I love asking all my guests some version of this final question, David. Let's imagine you're pottering around in your polytunnel, tending to your non-cannabis plants, and a garden elf pops up and offers you three wishes to make healthcare better, what would you wish for? Probably a dog that doesn't snore.
Yes. Some sort of office that I don't have to share with a dog. Yeah, you could say that I'm well and truly in the doghouse in this family.
Very good.
What I'd love to do is to really build on my sort of interdisciplinary working and research. I'd love to have enough money where I could really bring computer scientists, robotic engineers, you know, the technologists all together under the same roof to start really pushing forward our thinking and our research that we're going to need in the future. I think there's huge opportunities available to us. You know, the next generation of surgeons aren't going to be surgeons. They're going to be surgical technologists. They're going to be applying the sciences, the physical sciences, the computer sciences. They're going to be applying this technology to patient problems. And so building the infrastructure to achieve that, I think, would be very, very exciting. I think the second wish, I think the NHS is fabulous for certain things. And we've seen that during the COVID pandemic, and particularly the response, the vaccines response has been fantastic, how collaborative research has really come together and has shown what we can do when we do truly work together. And the NHS is great for that, but it doesn't work as well for other things. And the other, one of the main things that frustrates me is the IT infrastructure, how fragmented that is. So if you do have digital solutions, it is very difficult to roll them out across the NHS because the digital environments are so different. So I think that's something that NHSX is trying to sort. But I think it's a big problem at the moment. And then I think my third wish would be I really believe in the power of our young trainees. So I think the future relies on our youngsters taking up the baton and pushing forwards with the innovation. They're the ones with the creative minds, with the enthusiasm to really push things forwards. So I'd like to see some major investment into more innovation opportunities and training opportunities for our young surgeons, because we're going to be heavily reliant on them for the future. And, you know, I can't learn the basics of computer science, coding, you know, it's beyond my old head now. But the youngsters, they have the ability to do this. They have the ability to learn the language, to speak to the people who we need to bring the innovation through for us. So some sort of investment and greater opportunity for our youngsters.
Well, all great points. Professor David Jain, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. And thank you for your dog for taking the time to be with us today and for everything that you've done and continue to do for patients and to make all of us think and consider ways to be better at what we do.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's great to have the opportunity to chat to you.
And, well, I'm going to be in Leeds soon, as I said in our last email, and I'm looking forward to a one-on-one conversation, just like we used to do. Well, everyone, that's all we have time for today, unfortunately. Please check out all the prior shows that are archived at emg-health.com. emg-health.com. And subscribe to hear new podcasts every Friday. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious, and maybe get a better night's sleep so you don't snore during the day. Bye for now.